Hello, I'm Emma Smith, and I'm an occupational therapist and assistive technology professional working with Jumpstart Occupational Therapy and the University of British Columbia. Today we're going to be chatting about alternative access to mobile technology for computing, communication, and environmental control. Just to get us started, I just want to mention that I don't have any relationships that constitute a conflict of interest for this, so any references that I make to specific products as we go through shouldn't be considered an endorsement. We've got a few learning outcomes today that we're going to try to achieve. So the first is that at the end of this, I want to be able to have you describe three ways that mobile technologies can be used to control the environment for individuals with disabilities. Following that, I really hope that you'll be able to describe three different access methods which can be used by individuals who have difficulty accessing a touch interface. And finally, I'd like you to be able to apply an understanding of alternative access for mobile devices to three case studies that we're going to review. I have one real goal though for today, and that is to bring you from a point where you think that access to environmental controls and mobile devices for individuals with disabilities might be a little overwhelming, but I want you to get to a point where you think that it's possible, that it's exciting, and that it's full of potential. Because I think there's some really great things here, and I want you to think that too. We're going to talk about a few things. So the first thing we're going to talk about is what I'm actually meaning by mobile technologies. Talk a little bit about that. Then we're going to talk about some of the capabilities of mobile technologies and what they can actually do. Then we're going to get into the meat of it, which is the access to mobile technology and how somebody can actually use these devices. And then finally, we're going to go through a few case studies. So hopefully by the end of that, we'll be able to achieve those objectives that we talked about at the beginning. So what is mobile technology? What are these devices that we're talking about? They're devices that you probably use every day. So when you look at these pictures, you're going to see some Apple devices. So on screen there, you'll see an Apple iPad as well as an iPhone. So those are mobile technologies. You'll also see some Android tablets and phones there on the right-hand side. Those are also considered mobile technologies. So anything like a tablet or a smartphone, that's what we're going to be talking about in terms of what mobile technology actually is. And then down at the bottom, you're going to see a series of smartwatches. So those are a new addition to the mobile technology lineup, and I think that this really adds to what our capabilities are in terms of mobile technology. When we think about what those capabilities are, there's a huge range of capabilities. So we're going to talk about these more in depth as we go through these slides. But some of the things you might think about are everyday computing, that's access to your email or to your texting, or maybe it's to play a game on your phone, those everyday computing kind of things. Communication, which is that access to augmentative and alternative communication or speech generating devices. And environmental controls, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about environmental controls in the next few slides because I think it's where there's really a lot of potential. And health monitoring devices, and I'll talk a little bit more about those as well. So I wanted to talk to you about environmental control options. I think that for many of the clients that we work with who have difficulty with physical access, that environmental control options become really, really critical. So we've got lighting available. So that's one way that we can control our environment is by turning on and off our lights. And we can now do that through our tablet or through our smartphone, so that's really cool. We've got the capability to do this through the use of light bulbs. So we have Wi-Fi enabled light bulbs that allow us to work with a system and turn those light bulbs on and off. And the nice thing about those light bulbs is they can be used in any fixture. So you just use that light bulb like you would any other light bulb and connect it to your device, and then you've got access to turn that light on and off. We also have light switches, which can be Wi-Fi enabled, so those can be used in place of a regular switch, and they can be standard switches, motion detecting, or even dimming switches. So we have lots of control over our lights using alternative switches hardwired into our wall. And then we have the option to control lights which would normally plug into an outlet through through outlet control. So we can get a small device which plugs into the outlet, which is Wi-Fi enabled, which we then plug the light into, and that gives us access to our lighting. We also have the option to control some things around heating and safety. So these would be things like Wi-Fi enabled thermostat. The one you see on the screen there is the Nest, which is probably the most well-known of the thermostats, but certainly not the only one. It allows you to control things like heat in your home or cooling if you have a cooling system. And we also have access to Wi-Fi enabled security systems. So those might be security systems like you would already have installed, where you'd have motion detectors in your home or door or window detectors, but you can turn them on and off using the Wi-Fi system and using your mobile device. They might also be something like a camera at the front door so that you can actually see who's coming to ring your doorbell, and you can use that as a security system. And all of that can be accessed through your phone or your tablet. Finally, we have things like water heaters, and I know you think to yourself, why on earth would I need a water heater which is mobile enabled or Wi-Fi enabled? But it does give access to things that you might not be able to use otherwise if you have limited physical capacity. So being able to change the heat settings on that water heater through Wi-Fi device might be useful to you. We have many more options when it comes to things like doors and windows. So we can actually now control the lock on our front door, that deadbolt lock, using a Wi-Fi enabled device. And one of the great things about these is they can require proximity to the door to be activated, or a specific code, which means that for some of our users who might have, they might be using a wheelchair, and they may not have physical access to that deadbolt, when they have proximity to the door, they can have it open for them. We could also mean that we can give access to caregivers. So maybe they have a code that they can have access to, and they can access that door through their phone, and the person who they're working with doesn't necessarily need to allow them access to the door or let them in the door. So that's really cool. We've also got options for Wi-Fi enabled door openers. The door can open automatically when you hit a switch on your phone, as well as Wi-Fi enabled doorbells, so you can see, like I said, who's on the other side of that door. Thinking about windows, we've got access to blinds and curtains, so we can actually open and close the blinds using Wi-Fi enabled devices, and that means we get access through our smartphone to those blinds and curtains, but it also means that we can set particular settings. So we could say, if I get home at 7 p.m. and the blinds are open and it's after sunset, let's say in the winter, please close the blinds. And your device can do that for you, and it can do it based on your geolocation, but also based on where you are at the time and the time of day, or things like sunset. So we've got lots of options for how we can manipulate our environment through a Wi-Fi enabled device, and put specific settings in place to control it. Of course, one of the things that we're probably more familiar with would be things like entertainment, so our stereos or our speakers. Many of us are already using Bluetooth stereo and speakers in our home, so this is something we're familiar with or we're comfortable with. So stereos and speakers are one option. We also have the capacity to control our television or videos through the use of our smartphones or tablets, as well as gaming. So lots of options in terms of entertainment. And then appliances. So these are where I think it's, and there's some entertainment value from my perspective, but I think are really useful tools for some of our clients. We now have the capacity to have Wi-Fi enabled slow cookers and ovens and fridges and dishwashers. And what this means is that you can set settings without having to actually access the device itself and change things as you go about your day. So you could turn your dishwasher on before you came home, for example, or you could set that temperature on your oven without actually needing to access the buttons. So this presents a number of options for individuals with disabilities, which could make a significant impact on their life. In order to get this environmental control, there's some ways that we need to do some integration. So if you're an iOS or Apple device user, you've got HomeKit now built into your operating system. So HomeKit allows you to integrate with HomeKit-enabled devices, and it means that your Apple device, whether you use it through voice access or through touch or through a switch, is actually able to control those devices in your home. They are not certainly the only ones, so you can use something like SmartThings or the Amazon Echo to do the same thing. What you do need to make sure is that any devices that you are getting for the home or for any environment to control it are compatible with the interface or integration device that you have. So there are certain devices which are compatible with Amazon Echo and others which are compatible with HomeKit, but they might not necessarily be the same device. Nest, which is the thermostat I showed you earlier, also has integration capacities. So you might think about whether something's compatible with Nest. And as I'm saying these, I want you to make sure that you know that these aren't necessarily the only devices on the market. Many manufacturers have come out with integration devices, so it's worth doing a little bit of homework to determine what those integration devices are and what they're compatible with in terms of what you might already have in the home or what you might be wanting to purchase. The fifth one there on the screen is called IFTTT, which stands for If This, Then That. And IFTTT is a really great device or software, and it's available on Android and Apple devices, and it allows you to set if-then statements. So if I enter my home, turn on the hall light, for example. Or if the sun sets, then turn or close my blinds. So you have lots of options that you can set, and you can set recipes with IFTTT. And they are doing a lot at the moment, which is really exciting, around engaging people to create recipes and to create systems which can be used by other people. And so there's a very open source nature to that, and it allows you to really work cross-platform and work with a variety of different devices. And more devices are becoming IFTTT enabled. So really cool, exciting opportunities for IFTTT. So that's something you might want to learn about. When we think about the other capabilities of our mobile technology, one of these things is health monitoring. So there's ways we can do activity monitoring, and many of you probably do this already. You monitor your step counts, you monitor how many flights of stairs you go up a day, but that's not limited to those things. So it can also monitor things like, if you're using Apple, you can monitor, if you're a wheelchair, how many strokes you push on your wheelchair, what your distance traveled was. So they actually have settings where you can change your activity monitoring if you're a wheelchair user as compared to if you're a walker. There's also Bluetooth-enabled blood pressure cuffs now that are being produced. So if you have a client who needs to monitor their blood pressure on a regular basis, something like that might be helpful. Many devices, if they're using something like a smartwatch, like an Apple Watch or a Fitbit, they might be able to monitor their heart rate through that device. So this can be useful for getting health monitoring throughout the day and understanding what's happening to your heart rate and to your health as you go along. There's also lots of apps that help you to monitor things like your nutrition and your food intake, and there actually are some hardware devices which can help you do this as well, that can look at the weight, for example. There's a smart scale, food scale, that allows you to look at the weight of the food that you're consuming, and it will do all of the nutritional calculations for you. So if somebody's particularly concerned with nutrition, these are really cool options. We're also seeing Bluetooth-enabled water bottles, so measuring that water intake throughout the day and seeing how much water you're actually consuming. And for any of you who work with clients who have spinal cord injuries, this can be really important. We want to make sure that we're getting that water in and water out, and we're wanting to measure it. So having a device which actually measures how much water you're consuming during the day can be really important when it comes back to your health and how your systems are working. Lots of our devices are also now able to monitor our sleep, so to see how much sleep we're actually getting and what depth of that sleep is, and that can be done either through your mobile device, like your smartphone or your tablet, or it can be done through a smartwatch or a Fitbit. So you have options to monitor your sleep, and that may be useful if you're having difficulty or fatigue, and you can actually see if that person's getting the sleep they need. We've also got Wi-Fi monitored air purification systems now. So we can monitor lots of things that are relevant to our health and might be useful for people that we're working with. So now that we know a little bit about everything that our devices can do, we have to think about how we're actually going to achieve that. So when we think about typical access to a device, I want you to think about what you normally do every day. Assuming that you're a person who uses your device in a typical way, you probably do the majority of your access to your device through touch. So that would be through a tap on the screen, a swipe, a pinch, or a zoom if you're going to be looking at photos, for example, or you just want to expand something on your screen. So our typical access involves a lot of different touch movements throughout the day. And I want you to keep that in mind as we move forward, because this is a really critical point. We also use voice, so lots of us use virtual assistants like Siri or Cortana or OK Google. So those voice access options are considered sort of typical. There's something that somebody might use in an everyday way that might not necessarily be considered alternative for somebody with disabilities. But we have a real issue here. So the primary issue that we're concerned with is the fact that these features of the device are designed primarily for hand use. So that means that we have lock screens on our devices, which require us to swipe and tap in order to get past them. We have passwords which have to be inputted, it seems, at every turn, although more and more we're seeing fingerprint sensor. But consider if your client can't move their arm, if they're going to be able to use things like a fingerprint sensor. We also have menus, so everything you go into seems to have another menu that you need to access. We need to think about whether our clients can use those menu structures if they don't have access to their device in a typical way. One of the things that we really struggle with is that these apps we use aren't designed for alternative access. They weren't designed with the person with disability in mind. And so even if the device you're using, let's say it's an Apple device, has really great alternative access options built into it, the apps you're using may not have those great alternative access options built into them. So they may not be compatible with switch access, or they may not be compatible with VoiceOver. So we need to carefully consider what those apps are that we're using to make sure that they're going to work for our clients and they're not going to be too complex to be used with alternative systems. So there's lots of options for mobile device access. And this screen gives you an overview of what those device options look like. We start with touch, and when you think about these device options, we're really looking from more typical to less typical. So we start with touch. It's the most typical. It's how the devices were designed to be used. Direct touch is our primary access option, and that's that tap, swipe, zoom that we were talking about. But there are some alternatives to touch. So we can use assistive touch, which is in iOS or Apple devices, and that allows you to modify how the device responds to touch. But we might also use a stylus to access in a touch way, but not necessarily with our finger. So that's really on the typical side. On Android or Windows devices, we can use a mouse. And the use of a mouse can be great for targeting specific things on the screen, but unfortunately a mouse can't be used on an Apple device. So this might influence your choice of device if the person you're working with is a consistent mouse user. We also have access to keyboards, and these can be used across any devices, and being able to set up keyboard shortcuts. So again, these are still pretty typical. We then move into voice access, like Siri, Google, or others. Still in the more typical range than the less typical range. So getting access to those device features through our voice. And then switches. So iOS and Android both have great switch access options. Windows also has some switch access options. But switches are really along that less typical line. So if we're moving to switch options, it's usually because the options above have been tried and haven't worked for some reason or another for our client. I will tell you that I'm going to put in a little caveat here. There are a lot of features available for visual impairment, but I'm not covering them, primarily because it would be an entirely different set of information, an entirely different lecture. So while I may refer to things related to visual impairment, since some of our clients have both, my focus is really going to be on physical impairment. First, I'm going to talk a little bit about those device accessibility features and those general features which might be useful. So throughout this presentation, you'll see me refer to iOS, which is the operating system on Apple devices, or Android, which is the operating system on pretty much every other smartphone that you're going to encounter, with the exceptions of a Windows device. So anything coming from Samsung, Motorola, any of those other companies, they're going to use an Android-based operating system, although they might tailor it to their own needs. So when I'm referring to iOS and Android, that would be what I'm referring to. In each of these operating systems, we have specific device features which might be useful. So on iOS, we've got a number of features. They've done a really great job of building in accessibility. One of those features is called call audio routing, where you can actually route where the calls come in. So if you have a user who's got limited physical capabilities, but they have great voice and they're able to use the phone, maybe you want to consistently route that to their Bluetooth earpiece, because that's how they're going to communicate. And so that call can be consistently routed to that location, which can be switch-enabled, which makes it a lot easier for them. We've also got a device feature called LED flash for alerts, which means that the LED flash actually activates every time you've got an alert. So for somebody with some hearing impairment, this can be really useful for helping letting them know that there's something going on. We've got guided access, which is a way to control where the user is actually able to interact with the screen. And guided access can be particularly useful when we're teaching somebody new skills and we want to make sure that they don't get too lost inside the menu structures or in some of the settings, or that they don't accidentally change some of the settings, which we really need them to keep in mind. Text replacement is a keyboard function which allows us to do replacement of shorter forms of text for longer sentences. So you can spell out a sentence like, "The weather's great today," by only using three letters, for example, and a space. I use it all the time in my own life by putting in my email address with just my name and the at symbol and then a space, and my email address automatically pops up. But this can be used for accessibility features because it means they have to type fewer letters in order to get the same outcome. So it really diminishes the amount of time they have to spend interacting with that device or with that alternative access method. We can put restrictions on our devices to make sure that we don't accidentally do things that we don't want to do or change settings that we don't want to change. And we can also change those auto-lock settings. So whether or not the auto-lock comes onto the screen when there's been a period of inactivity. On Android, an additional feature that you might want to consider is high contrast text. So there's lots of visual features on all of our systems, but you might want to consider that for somebody who has difficulty seeing the screen, as lots of our clients do. I'm going to highlight these three, so guided access, text replacement, and predictive text. These are some really great ones, and I want to go into a little more depth on them, and I will do that later. So first, we're going to talk more about direct access. So direct access is access to the device in the way that it's intended to be used. So in an Apple device, that's touch only or touch plus voice activation through Siri. In Android, that's touch primary, but we do have the option to do mouse options as a secondary as well. So that's really great. And we use direct access whenever possible because it's the most normal or natural use of the device, and it's how most of our apps were set up to be used. That means that for somebody who doesn't have access to use consistent direct access, we might need to modify it. What are some of the reasons we might modify direct access? One would be that it means we have a more natural use of the device. We still get access to all of those things that the apps have been designed to do. We may have access to a wider range of apps, so maybe apps that weren't designed with somebody who has a disability in mind, or which wasn't designed with accessibility in mind. And modifying direct access means that we can address some of those challenges with targeting or discrete movements that some of our clients might have. Of course, there are limitations of modifying direct access. Sometimes the way we modify means that it's difficult to do all of the actions. So if you're using a stylus as a modification, for example, those multi-finger actions like pinch and zoom are probably going to be more difficult. It may also not address all of our users' needs. So there may be things that they have to do on a day-to-day basis which we can't do because of the way we've modified direct access. It may mean introducing new hardware, like a stylus, or new functions, so assistive touch as an example, which would be a new function that somebody might have to learn, which would mean that it means introducing that learning curve. And there is a learning curve for some which we need to consider. And if our clients have difficulty learning, we might want to consider whether this is really the best option for them. Our options in terms of modifying direct access would be to use things like simple assistive devices, like a stylus, which I mentioned before. Another way to do that would be for clients who have difficulty targeting a specific spot on the screen, who may have multiple fingers that get in the way, or the side of their hand which touches the screen and interacts with that touch interface. You can use a glove and just simply cut out the finger. You can just get a cheap glove, one of the stretchy ones, and cut the tip of the finger out, and that actually gives you targeted access with that finger without the rest of the hand getting in the way. You can also use keyboards, third-party keyboards, as well as keyboard settings to do certain things on your device, and this can help you get specific access in environments where you might have had more difficulty otherwise. Or maybe it's a client that you work with who has typically used a keyboard in the past, And so this allows them to get the same access that they've used before. So using keyboards are great. Third-party keyboards are keyboards which are on-screen, and they replace the on-screen keyboard that you typically use. So if any of you are Android users, you might know that you can use swipe to type, which is a gesture-based system of typing where you don't actually have to target each individual key. And you can actually get swipe for iOS now, which is great. So you can get a third-party keyboard option and allow even more options for those on-screen keyboards. You can also use touch accommodations or assistive touch on iOS, which just changes how the device responds to your touch or gives you alternatives for touch options on those iOS systems. Talked a little bit about keyboards as a peripheral, but you can also use mice. So if you've got a client who's very used to using a specific mouse or a specific keyboard with their computer that they've used in the past, we can actually connect those to Android devices or to Windows devices to make sure that they're able to continue using that access system that they're used to. For keyboards, you also want to think about the fact that they can be used on Apple devices as well, but they don't have quite as much flexibility in terms of connecting all keyboards. They typically have to be a Bluetooth keyboard. There is one device on the market which allows you to connect any USB keyboard to a Bluetooth broadcasting device, which you can then get connection to your tablet or your phone, which makes a huge difference because the person is able to access it consistently. So in terms of simple assistive devices, I'm going to go through a few challenges which might give you options for how you could solve a particular problem. So one challenge would be hand positioning, for example. So where other fingers might be getting in the way or the hand is resting on the screen, we can use, like I talked about, gloves with cutouts. But those gloves could also use a capacitive thread or glue just put onto the tip of the glove, which allows them access to the very specific point. What I really like about this as well is if a person's really great at targeting with something other than their finger, you could potentially do it on a knuckle or on another area where it might be more useful for them. You can also use splints to provide more targeted finger use so that you have only the finger you're looking to use accessing the screen. Another challenge might be if the fingers aren't ideal, but they have good general targeting in terms of position. And sometimes this happens just because of somebody's fingernails or their angle of their fingers when they touch the screen. Sometimes it's because of how the screen reacts to their fingers or the positioning of their hand. So in this case, we might provide alternative touching devices like a stylus or, again, those knuckles, the use of capacitive glue or thread on gloves or doing cutouts. So there's lots of ways we can do this really cheaply and really simply for those clients who may be able to target somewhat, but maybe not perfectly. Of course, we've talked a little bit already about peripherals. So a Bluetooth keyboard may be easier for someone to target than an on-screen keyboard, which is really exciting because it means that they're able to get a greater range of access to their device. It's also possible to interact with the system through your keyboard. So you have the potential to actually do things on the system, like open and close home screens through the keyboard rather than having to touch the device itself. There are some devices, like I said, that are able to connect any keyboard to any tablet via Bluetooth, so those are worth considering. Can I just pause for a second, Carl? Sorry, my screen just wasn't coming up, so I think it's there now. Okay, I think we should be good. I just had a blank screen.
Okay. If you want, you can start from the beginning of the slide, if you like, or pretty much anywhere, and then I'll just go in and touch it up afterwards.
Okay, I'll start from the beginning of this slide.
Okay, we'll do another countdown just to so that I have some time to clip.
Yep, great.
Okay, ready?
Yep.
Okay, in 5, 4, 3.
Another peripheral that might be able to be used is a mouse. So again, this is only for Android or Windows systems that have a USB connection. This gives you full mouse control of the system, and it can be done in a variety of ways. You can get a Bluetooth mouse, which connects to the system, and those are made specifically for this purpose, or you can get a hardwired mouse. So if you have a Bluetooth port or even a micro, sorry, not a Bluetooth port, a USB port or a micro USB port, you can connect that mouse through that port using an adapter or using a micro USB, or you can do it through an interface device. But what's great here is that possibility to use any mouse which works for your client and the possibility to use a head mouse. So if you have a client who's really used to using a head mouse on their PC, you can then use that head mouse, in this case, on an Android or a Windows system. So that's a really great access option. Of course, then we also have the option for voice access. So if you have a clear speaking voice, you have the potential to interact with your device through speaking. Depending on the operating system you're using, you may have access to Siri, Google, or Cortana. These operating systems all allow you to have interaction with most of your device through voice access. So what that means is that there's very specific things that your device can do through speech, but there are also things that are limited by speech. A great example is that it's easy to open an app using your voice, but most apps don't have access to use that app with voice access. So you might want to consider what that's going to mean for your clients that you're working with. You can do things like send an email, and that will work flawlessly within the system, but say you want to navigate within a website, that may not work. So consider that when you're setting this up. There are also apps that provide specific voice options, such as Dragon, and I find that the voice tends to be the best when we're considering using it for things like dictation or for simple commands like sending a text, sending an email, or calling somebody. So there are ways to interact for using voice, but I always recommend you have a backup access method if possible. So the next access option is switch access. Switch access allows you to control your entire device with one or more switches. And this is really great for somebody who has very limited motor capacity. When you're using these switches, you can be using any variety of switches. So these may be anything that your client is used to using or has used in the past. So that may be a simple button, a lever, a proximity switch. It could be a movement sensor or any other sensor that they're using. It could be sip and puff if that's what they're used to using with their wheelchair, for example. So we really have a wide variety of switches that we're able to use and to see. So for those of you who are not familiar, switches work by completing an electrical circuit. So when we activate the switch, it completes a circuit, which sends a signal to the device we're using. So as you see in this animation, when we turn the switch on, just like a light bulb, it closes that loop and turns on the target device. This is the same way that a switch works with a tablet or a phone, but it has to be done through an interface device. So when we think about switch access, we're thinking about single or multiple switch use. We're also looking at a variety of switches and specific interfaces. And the ideal device depends on the user's capabilities, but also the intended use of the switch and the device. As I said, switches can't plug directly into devices. They do need to have an intermediate device or an interface. And switches talk to that device through that interface. So we activate the switch, it engages with the interface, and that interface then engages with the tablet in a way that the tablet understands, or the phone. So we have to always have that interface device. There are a few switches on the market which have built-in interface devices, but they are probably in the minority as compared to the switches that you would more likely be using with most of your clients. So make sure that you know you've got the right interface device for your tablet or phone, as well as the switch which connects to it. When we think about what interface devices we actually have available to us, we have wireless and wired devices. So there's some pros and cons. With wireless, we have the capacity to continue to charge the device while we use the interface, but it means that that device requires charging. So it's something you want to think about. Is it something that your client can charge every day at the end of the day? We also need to make sure that that wireless device is going to continue to stay paired to the device that your client is using throughout the day so that they don't lose access to their device through the course of the day when they need them. A wired device means that there's no charging required for the device itself, but and you don't have any of those challenges associated with pairing, which sometimes we experience with Bluetooth devices. So with a wired device, that means it's actually plugged into your tablet or your phone, and that means that it's sometimes occupying the charging port. Some of those devices now have charge-through ports, which is really great because it allows you to charge through the interface device, but for those that don't, you want to make sure that your client's going to have enough battery power to last them throughout the day while they're using their interface, because you wouldn't want them to be stuck without access to their device when they need it. So I'm going to go through something now, which is a little bit of a before you start here. If you are using an iOS device and you want to practice, I highly recommend that you use the accessibility shortcut to turn on and off switch control. This also goes for any of the clients that you might be working with and their caregivers. The client may be competent at using switch control, but their caregiver may not be. So to have an easy access way to turn on and off switch control on the device is really important to make sure that that client gets the support they need from the caregivers that are in their environment. So I'm going to switch here to a quick video to show you how to turn on accessibility shortcut to make sure that you have access to that device all the time. So what you'll see here on the screen is a quick video, and I'm just going to get it to start playing here. And this video is how to turn on the accessibility shortcut, which is found in Settings. And you just scroll down to General, then to Accessibility, and then scroll all the way down to the bottom, because they like to hide these things on us. And when you get down to the bottom, you'll see accessibility shortcut sitting there down at the bottom. And you're going to click on that, and you're going to make sure that switch control is checked. I would recommend that you do not check anything else, only switch control. Then you can exit out of that. And now when you triple-click the home button, switch control will turn on. And similarly, when you triple-click the home button, switch control will turn off. And that off is the most important part, because if you're not yet familiar with using switch control, it can be difficult to get out of it if you can get stuck. So I always recommend that accessibility shortcut. So now that we've got that out of the way, we can talk a little bit about those switch access options. So I'm going to focus largely on iOS at this point, because iOS really has the most robust switch access options of the mobile devices that we have available to us. And I will go through a little bit about Android later on. But from now on, we're going to be talking mostly about iOS. So iOS has three forms, essentially, of switch access. The first two are relatively similar. So we have item scanning, which scans one item at a time. Very simple, but it is slow. So if you're looking for efficiency, this is probably not the way to go. Item scanning has a second option, which is called grouping items, which allows you to do a row-column scan. So it means that it groups the items by row to begin with, and you select the row that your item is located in. And then once you've selected the row, it goes through each of the items in that row by column so that you can select the specific item. It's more complex to use, but it is faster and more efficient, and most people who have some cognitive capacity for switch use end up finding that row column is more efficient and a better use than item scanning. The third option is a little bit different, and this is called cross-scanning. So cross-scanning targets a very specific area on the screen by bringing a vertical bar across the screen until you ask it to stop. And then it brings a horizontal bar down the screen until you are able to find the exact point on the screen where the two lines meet to target the specific area. This requires the most attention from the user and the most cognitive capacity, so it may be a matter of working with your client to see what works best with them. This system has high complexity, and that scares a lot of people, and a lot of people who are learning as clinicians or support people or caregivers, the complexity often scares them in the beginning. But what's really cool is that that complexity means it has great potential. So if you can learn to harness that complexity, you can really do some powerful things with switch control. iOS is very powerful, but I urge you to keep it simple. So make sure that you keep it as simple as it can be for your client to use all the functions that they need to be. It doesn't have to be complex, and it doesn't have to be difficult. It's all about your learning and making sure that you are competent in using these devices to their fullest potential. I'm going to switch to another video here, which shows you the complexities. So as this video loads, you'll see that this is how complex the system can be. And I want you to just keep this in mind as you're watching this, that this has a lot going on. So there's multiple menu structures. You can get lost in those menu structures. You may find yourself finding things that you didn't intend to find. There's really too much going on for the average user. So here there's actually two pages of menus. There's multiple things you're probably not going to use on a day-to-day basis, and that may not actually be relevant to your client. If they're never going to drag something, then it's not going to be relevant for them to have that within their menu structure. When we're looking at these complexities, we want to think about what are they going to use the most? What functions are going to be the most important for them and the functions that they're actually going to use? As you see, we've got lots more going on here on the screen, so now we've activated something called Force Touch, which isn't terribly useful for most assistive device users, because they can activate all of those other things through other means without having to go through this complex menu structure. So that gives you a sense of what those menu structures can look like, and the level of complexity that you can have if you have a very high capacity, high needs user. For most of our users, however, that complexity is just too much. So it's better if we can look at a more simple solution. So I'll switch to another video here. And this video is going to show you a simpler solution for iOS. And as you're watching this go through, you'll see that we've got it now into row column scanning, so it's scanning the rows first. We're going to select the column we want and the device we want. You're seeing no menu structures come up, so we're seeing what's called auto tap, which means that as soon as we hit that switch, it activates a tap function. You can also set it so the menu can come up if you want it, but it doesn't have to come up if you don't want it. And that makes it a whole lot easier on most of our clients, and you'll see this interface is significantly simpler than the last one that we were looking at. So this makes a big difference for most of our clients, is getting to this level of simplicity. And really, the way we get to that simplicity is through our own competence with the use of the device and understanding all of the different features and functions. So I would urge you to practice and play with your devices if you have access to them to make sure that you really fully understand those options. So in iOS 10, we have updated switch control features, but keep in mind that iOS 7 and above all have switch control. So that means if you're using an older device that can't necessarily update to the new iOS, you might be able to use that switch control. If you're watching this at a later date, and it's after the fall of 2017, you'll also have access to new switch control features, which you may not see in iOS 11, which you won't see here today. So in iOS switch control, we have access to a variety of switches through Bluetooth or a wired switch. We also have access to two alternatives, so a head control and a full screen control. I haven't found the head control to be particularly reliable, so I wouldn't recommend it. But the full screen controls are a really interesting option because it allows you to activate switches without any additional hardware, no switch and no interface device. What it does is it sets your entire screen up to be a switch, which means that anytime you tap the screen, it behaves as though a switch has been hit. This is really great for learning yourself without having any interface devices, so you might want to do that and try that out. Remember to turn on that accessibility shortcut first. But it's also great for showing and training and teaching. It might also be really good for a client who can target the screen but can't actually target a specific location. So if they can get that hand over to the screen to hit the screen, maybe that's all you need. Maybe you don't need an expensive switch or an interface to make it happen. Switch control is completely programmable through the main menu, and you can do scanning, so row column scanning, or point scanning like I showed, like I told you about earlier. You can also do this with or without VoiceOver, so for those clients who might have visual impairment, you can add VoiceOver to it, and there's lots of adjustments. I'm going to show you some of them. for speed, hold length, repeat, and release times. And I'll talk to you a little bit more about those details as we go through the next few slides. So I'm going to go through the settings as they are currently. Keep in mind these may change with subsequent updates, but they should be relatively similar. The first thing that you're seeing there is the capacity to turn switch control on and off. If this is your first time using it, remember to make that accessibility shortcut first before you actually hit this button, or you'll have difficulty turning it off at a later time. The next one is set up your switches. So if you go into that setting, you can actually set up your switches in there, and that's where you'll set up a full screen switch if you're interested in learning how to use on your own, or you just want to do some playing around with switch control. The following one is called recipes, and recipes are a way for you to get your device to do things consistently when you execute a particular action. And this can be done inside a particular app. So, for example, you can set up a recipe to turn pages inside iBooks. It means that you can simplify things for your clients if they're going to do a consistent action or an action that they're going to do regularly that you want to be able to give them access to. For timing, which is your next section, you've got a whole bunch of different features. So auto-scanning time, that's the time that it takes for the scan to proceed. How often the scan, or how much time it's going to take for the scan to move to the next item. You also, and so what you're seeing in the image is that because auto-scanning is turned on in this case, which is that scanning style function, you're not going to see all of the other functions. So you have three scanning styles: auto-scanning, manual scanning, and switch scanning. So you've got, you'll see there's three different codes there for A, M, and S. So there are different timing functions for each of the three different codes, just as we go through this. So dwell time, if you're going to use a scan where you don't actually have a second switch, which is going to be able to activate that scan, or you're not going to do an auto tap, dwell time is when, how long it takes that switch, or how long it dwells there before it moves on. Auto hide is how quickly your menu disappears for you. Pause on first item is in auto scanning, so if somebody's actually going to be using auto scanning, will it pause on the first item just to give them a chance to collect themselves? Loops is how many times it will loop around. Move repeat is how often that move will repeat itself. And then long press is that it can actually assign a separate function to a long press of the switch so that you can have a single switch do more than one function. What's great about iOS is each of these switch settings are explained inside the accessibility system. So if you don't understand what it means, then you can get a simple description of it inside the system. There's also some resources which I'll throw you to at the end of the presentation for you to get access to understand a little bit better. The next is around tap behaviors. So you have three tap behaviors, which are default, which is that the menu comes up when you tap, auto tap, which means that it will consistently tap when you hit the button, unless you press the switch twice, in which case the menu will come up. And then you have this third one called always tap, which is where the selection will immediately go to the item instead of the menu, and that the menu will appear at the very end of the scan. So either always tap or auto tap are recommended from my perspective because it prevents that menu to come up, and then the menu can be available to you if you need it. Always tap keyboard keys is a really great function which allows you to always make sure that when you're in the keyboard and using it that the menu doesn't come up, even if you have your default tap settings on, because most people don't need a menu when the keyboard's available to them. There's also some options for switch stabilization. So this is how long you need to hold the switch for it to activate. Great for clients who have some extra movement and they might accidentally hit the switch. You can set it to be a little longer, or to ignore repeated access to the switch. So somebody who has a tremor who might hit the switch multiple times by accident, you can ignore repetitions within a certain amount of time. For point scanning, we can set the speed for the gliding cursor. And then we've got some audio functions. So we can turn on and off sound effects and turn on and off speech, which is a little bit like VoiceOver, but a little less robust. also select the menu items that we want. So that big menu that you guys all saw come up earlier, we don't need that to have all of those functions all of the time. So consider setting your menu items to only include those functions which your client needs. Finally, we've got group items, which is that difference between single item scanning and grouped item scanning that you saw earlier, as well as some visual changes. I always recommend a large cursor. I find it way easier to see. And change the cursor color to something that will be recognizable by your client and also contrasts with the background on their device. You can also save gestures, which are specific gestures that they can activate using specific switch items. Here you'll see images of item scanning just to give you a visual. So here you can do either individual item scan or row column scanning. And this works well with apps that have discrete buttons. It doesn't work very well with apps which are a little more complex. And on the next one, you see point scanning. So point scanning is that cross scanning I was talking to you about. So it brings a vertical bar across and then allows you to refine your position within that vertical bar. And then that horizontal bar, and you'll see the width there on the image. The horizontal bar comes down the screen, and then you're able to refine within that horizontal bar. This is really great for apps which are not ideal and don't have very discrete buttons. So why would I choose iOS over something else? One great reason is that it has compatibility with your existing environmental controls for a user who uses those in their environment, but also because they have more robust communication apps for clients who might use AAC or speech-generating devices. Of course, we always have to consider our clients and their needs around preference, so some of our clients will prefer it because of the mainstream nature or because of the cool factor of having an Apple device. But really where I think the real power is that potential to increase the complexity as they become more familiar with the device. Or, on the flip side, to reduce the complexity to its basic, most simple state for a client who doesn't need that complexity or can't handle that complexity. There's also consistency. So if you get a new device, your settings can be ported exactly through a backup, and you're not going to have to do any new learning when you get a new device. So I recommend it for consistency alone as well. Thinking about Android switch access, and I did promise I'd get to this, we do have integrated switch access in Lollipop 5.0.2 and beyond. This can be found in accessibility in the settings, but the options at the moment are very limited, so you don't have full access to everything in your device through Android switch access. There are some challenges. For example, it's a little bit more difficult to see, and you have more limitations with a single switch, so it's not necessarily going to work for everyone, but it might work for some people. There are some benefits to Android that you don't get in iOS. One of those is that you can actually build apps within Android which use switch access, which don't rely on the Android operating system switch access programming. So there are apps available on the market which are built for switch access, and they are very robust. We don't see that in Apple. We also have the option for the use of a mouse with a Bluetooth connection. So for those clients who might have a wheelchair joystick that they're used to using or a Bluetooth mouse emulator, this is a really great way to get access to a tablet without having to do a full switch system. The other thing I love about Android, which we don't have access to on Apple, is the use of something called a launcher. So this actually replaces the home screen of your Android device and allows you to use the device in a way that is simplified and really great for those clients with diminished cognition or who aren't familiar with technology. So I find launchers really great for young kids because it limits what they're able to do on the device, but also for older adults because they can we can limit their device so that it's less complex and less of a learning curve for them. And launchers can be used with switch access, which is a really nice feature. In terms of the switch options that are available for Android, we do have an auto-scanning option, and you can turn it on or off. So if you have one switch, you can auto-scan, or you can do a two-switch scan with alternatives. We then have the option to set up a switch to go to the next area or to a previous, so that can be a single switch, or you can set up a switch array. We can set switches up to activate clicks or long clicks, scrolling forwards or backwards, going back or home, as well as notifications or quick settings or recent apps. So they're much more specific about the exact things that switches activate as opposed to Apple, which generally allows access to the full device. So the visual interface, it can be difficult to see. As I mentioned earlier, there's no grouping of items in the same way, although this may change with subsequent versions of Android, which would be helpful. And activation can be hit or miss, so you will at times find that you don't actually get everything that you need to get when you hit your switch. It's still early for Android, and they are working on new systems, but we're not quite there yet in the way that we are with Apple. So this quick video is going to show you the use of an Android switch system. So as you see, this is an Android screen, and you'll see the visual interface is not quite as robust as it is on the Apple system. We've got single item scanning, very similar to what we had on the Apple system, and it does click through. You'll see a few other things there on my screen, like Big Launcher, which is a great launcher, or Click to Phone, which is a great switch-enabled app. So there are those options available to you. So the Android interface is just a little bit different, and it does bring up a menu, but the menu is not quite as polished as the one you'll see on Apple. I mentioned launchers earlier, so to give you an image of what a launcher might look like, this is Big Launcher, which I mentioned, which is a fully customizable launcher, so you can choose what goes into each of those six boxes, which means you can set your phone up or your tablet exactly for the person who's using it. It replaces the home screen, and there are both free and paid versions, and it's just really excellent for those individuals who might need some simplification in their device. So why would I choose Android over Apple? I would choose it because of its ease of simplification, certainly for people who may have direct access options but difficulty targeting and need a bigger target, or for those who just may be overwhelmed by the complexity of one of the other devices. Also, access to the all-in-one solution. So if you're going to use a mouse and touch and a head mouse or whatever combination you need, Android will give you that option. There's also the great potential for app development. It's much easier to do an app for an Android device and get it onto the market than it is on Apple. This comes with pros and cons, of course, because not all apps are really well built, but it does mean that you have more potential for app development. A big selling feature is the cost. The cost of Android devices tends to be significantly lower than the cost of Apple devices. And for joystick users, the potential for mouse integration, or really for any mouse user, the potential for mouse integration is really quite powerful. There is still the option to use Windows Surface tablets, and they are getting more and more sophisticated, and it gives you access to a full Windows environment. We're able to use them through USB access for a mouse with a head mouse or a Swiftie if you're needing to put a switch in. We can also bring on Windows software like Dragger or CrossScanner, which can give us access to that device. So anything you could previously do on a Windows system, you can get access to on a Windows Surface tablet. Of course, making it work with life is an important consideration because we're often dealing with individuals who need wheelchairs. So not everyone who needs switch access uses a wheelchair, but many do. And not everyone who needs switch access uses a powered wheelchair, but some do. So it's important to think about how we integrate that. And there is a separate presentation which you can see, which is all related to this integration piece. And we'll go much more into depth on this. For mounting, you're going to need to consider how the person's accessing the device, whether they have good line of sight, what transportation needs they may have around mounting and unmounting their device, as well as the cost of available mounting options. There may be commercial or off-the-shelf options that you can target. For wheelchair integration, you do have the option for the Bluetooth mouse or switch connection for powered wheelchairs, so you'll want to consider your wheelchair controls when you're working with your client, what they have access to already, whether you're going to use some external switches, and whether you may use a combination of both. Finally, I'll go briefly through some case studies, and if you see our integration presentation, you'll also see these same case studies there. So the first case study was a teen who had a lot of extra movement, and we had some difficulty with switch access. Her control of her hands was great when it was positioned well, but if she accidentally moved because of that extra movement, she could hit her switch accidentally. And she really wanted to be as normal as possible as a teen. She had multiple switch sites which we were able to identify, which was helpful, and she was using her device as a communication device, but as well for general day-to-day activity. So for her, we moved to an Apple device because it gave her the cool factor of being a teen and having an iPad like her peers, but it also meant that we could set up some really robust switch options for those multiple switches. Gave her full control over the device, and we had to make sure we mounted those switches in a really great place for her to access them. Our second case study would be an adult with C4 quadriplegia, and he was a sip and puff driver who had really clear and good voice output. He did have two switch access sites on the right and left sides of his head. One of them was used for a mode switch for his wheelchair, so we were cautious about using that side so that we didn't interfere with that mode switch on his wheelchair. And he was cognitively intact, so that made it a little easier for us to manipulate those switch settings. He was able to use some more complexity, but he wanted to use email, his calendar, his browser, and he wanted to integrate with his computer, which was a Mac at home. So again, we used an Apple device, and that was because we were able to use that depth of complexity for him, and we were able to set up one switch to activate Siri so he could use voice access when possible, and then he was able to use another switch to activate his switch access systems when Siri wasn't absolutely best at activating some of the things within apps. He specifically asked not to use his sip and puff system for his wheelchair because he didn't want another straw and his wheelchair electronics were not capable of integrating. In our third case study, we had a teen who had muscular dystrophy and very limited strength who fatigued easily, and that fatigue was a real concern. So we wanted to make sure we weren't introducing anything new which was going to cause any additional fatigue. He was cognitively well and very interested in computer programming and being able to modify his own devices. So we got him an Android device because we knew he could use his wheelchair joystick, which was a micro joystick, in order to activate a Bluetooth mouse on his tablet. So Android worked really well for him because he was a mouse user, but also because he liked the complexity of the Android interface and liked to be able to play around with it. So that worked for him. There are a variety of resources which you can activate, including the AbleNet Switch Guide, which is a very helpful resource, as well as a resource that I created, which was an iOS Switch Guide, which just looks at it from a little bit of a different perspective. So I would recommend that you take a look at some of those guides and see what works for you. There's also a really great book on the iBooks website on iOS, specifically called Hands Free, which is written by a fellow named Christopher Hills, who's based in Australia, who's a Switch user himself. So he's produced this iBook, and it's available for free on the iTunes website. RJ Cooper, who manufactures Switch devices, also has a great website, and they have a number of resources that you can access. And you'll find a number of wonderful resources on YouTube. So just anything you're having difficulty with, somebody's probably created a video for you. So you can just search YouTube for the challenge that you're having, and you will likely find a solution to that challenge. Of course, if you have any questions, you're always welcome to contact me, and my email address is listed here if you'd like to take note. So I do welcome any contact that you might have or any questions, and I hope that we've been able to achieve our objectives today and that you've enjoyed this presentation, and I look forward to speaking with you soon.